Why, hello. What do you have in mind to talk about today?
No. I'm trying to be a tiger, you know, like a tiger mom.
Ah, the famous tiger mom. I thought we would be talking about something else.
Ha ha, very funny. Or the tiger parent. It's not just mom. The phrase tiger mom made famous by Amy Chua's best-selling book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother in 2011, has created a lot of controversies regarding the traditional ways of parenting in East Asian families. Now, tiger parenting has become a really well-known concept in our culture, and some people are really for it, and some people really hate it. So I thought in the spirit of Chinese New Year, it's February, it's the beginning of a new ox year, I thought it would be a great opportunity for us to demystifying it for everyone, because there are pros and cons in every style of parenting.
And who better to talk about this than you, who grew up in Beijing, the motherland of tiger parenting, but also lived in Europe and now in North America.
Thanks for that intro, honey. I actually do think I have quite a bit of understanding on this topic, but our intention here today is to educate and explain, not to stereotype. Hopefully we can understand this differences between parenting philosophy a little better and take some of the good and leave some of the bad in every philosophy to suit your life. Welcome to episode 5 of Parents Uninterrupted. We're here to have an honest conversation to help you live a fulfilling life while raising children. And today we're talking about the difference between East Asian parenting versus Western style parenting and their pros and cons.
Wait, I have a question for you. Are you a tiger parent?
I really wish I were to some degree. It's just too much work to be a tiger mom.
Wait a second. So why is it so much work? What is the actual difference here?
Okay, I have given it a lot of thoughts around this because there are so many little nuances I think Asian parents do differently from Western parents. Deep-rooted in philosophy, but I have summarized the main differences between philosophy, like on a deeper mental level, in 3 categories.
Let me guess. The first category will emphasize on good grades in school, like Asian expectation grades.
Right on. I think when we think about tiger parenting or Asian parenting, that's the first thing that comes to mind, at least in our pop culture. And that's the one big difference we really notice. I would say it's well known for tiger parents to put a big emphasis on academic achievements or expect good grades from the kids. It is, though, common among all parents. A lot of Western parents expect the same thing. But the reason why we coin it a tiger parent is when they take it. And tiger parents can be anybody from any background. It actually doesn't have to be associated with a particular race or skin color or culture. But they take it to a whole new different level, often demanding nothing but A's.
Wow. That's good to know.
So before we get into the pros and cons, I do want to explain a little bit of my understanding why there is this difference and why this difference is so deeply rooted. And I can't explain that without telling you a little piece of Chinese history. So bear with me here.
I love Chinese history.
It's a story. So in 587 AD, so we're talking about like 1500 years ago, the then emperor of China enforced a policy that had massive impact to Chinese society for years to come. The policy was for every year in the entire country, they would put out a very difficult standardized exam given to all willing male participants, no matter where you were, which family background you were from, you could write the exam if you wanted to.
Wow, that's like 1500 years ago. And that's pretty neat because that talks about how it spans different social classes, different standings in life. but as well as geographical regions, like right across China.
That's right. So that was, I think, the beginning of meritocracy, at least a level of meritocracy in Chinese society, when it was imperial and it was like you're born into a specific status. This kind of started the whole idea of you have upward mobility if you try hard enough. So all papers written by applicants would be submitted and reviewed by the government officials. And for those who scored really high, they would be called upon and given a post or job directly within the government. The post would arrange something small, like from local grassroots government officials. It could go up to something really significant, depending on the scores and how impressive their essays were. So this provided young people of the time a chance to climb the ladder and to have a chance to serve the emperor in some capacity and with potential to earn great wealth and status. So there were many, many different stories, literatures, novels written about these rags to riches kind of story through this standardized exam. So when it was first announced, it quickly became every common Chinese family's dream to have a son who could do really well in academic achievements and score high on this exam. And this policy allowed upward mobility for the lowest and poorest of society in some ways really transformed the parenting philosophy and stressed the importance of academia. The policy was later adopted and perfected by subsequent emperors, reaching its high in Tang and Song and Qing dynasty, and was in place for at least 1300 years until 1905 in our 20th century.
Now this blows my mind because I just think about the logistics 1500 years ago on how you actually stand up this sort of standardized testing. I can actually see how it really shapes the way a person thinks.
Absolutely. Over 1500 years in a culture, that really makes it a deep-rooted philosophy. In 20th century, the standardized testing was temporarily stopped due to a lot of the wars and the political turmoil that was going on in China. Specifically the Second World War and a bunch of civil wars. But in 1949, when Mao established the Communist China, what is known same as today the People's Republic China, the standardized testings actually were reinstated and resumed. The difference was this time, because the Communist Party believe in women being equal to men and everybody had to be educated. So the standardized testing was written by everyone now, including all the females in the country as well. So today, we're talking about in 2021, this standardized testing system is fully embraced by China. I believe it is also in place in Korea and in Japan. So in China, they carry out this testing grade 7, grade 10, and for university entrance exam.
We all know that there's pros and cons to everything in life. So what would you say are the pros and cons of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this, so first of all, because of this piece of history, this philosophy of everybody has to do really well academically, it's so deep-rooted in Chinese parents' mind. And when they become immigrants, so a lot of the Chinese immigrants that moved to North America, Australia, the Western society in the 70s and 80s, or even earlier in the 90s, and education continued to be a focus point for those parents. Because now, not only it comes from the culture and the history, they also view it as a ticket for their subsequent generation to get a better job, and to have better social status in Western society. So definitely, I think supporting kids' education and expecting excellence obviously has a lot of pros. It pushes the kids to try really hard, and there's this value placed on schoolwork, and there's this pursuit of knowledge that's always encouraged. I think it's all good until you push it too far. I know in Asia today and in some of the households, in Asian households, in immigrant households in North America, the pressure on their children is tremendous. They're enrolled in all sorts of tutoring and they're expected to get nothing but the highest marks. This over a long time could really impact children's health or even physical, like mental health, or even leading to impact to physical health. I also find there's often a lack of balance between school grades and other subjects. So school grades mainly focus on math and English and reading and writing, all those main subjects, and which is very limiting considering everybody's very different, has strengths in different areas. I do notice there has been a shift of change in recent years where a lot of parents are now really into emotional intelligence and encourage their kids to participate in sports. So grades no longer are the be all and end all for Asian parents or for Tiger parents who adopt this kind of philosophy. But I think they continue to be a very important part of their expectation.
Yeah, and I actually see this quite a bit. But I also find that Asian parents still ask their kids to practice quite a bit. So that hasn't changed much.
Absolutely true. And this is the difference number two I really want to talk to you about. The philosophy of talent versus effort. In Asian culture, effort is worshipped much more than talent. And this could potentially go back to the Confucius philosophy. Again, it's been around for thousands of years, where I notice in Western society, talent is emphasized a lot. This, I find, can also be, just from my observation, can also be a part of the differences in English and Chinese language and how our words are constructed, which is really interesting. Because the way we speak and the way we describe something, I think over time can shape our philosophy and thinking as well. I'll give you an example. So in Canada and US and where Ethan and I live, we often hear parents describing their children or even other people's children as smart. Like we will say, oh, you know, he or she's so smart and they're so good at something. So there's kind of this implied association of a natural born ability of being smart to being good at the subject. In a typical Chinese household, this blows the mind of many Western parents and my friends that I know. The typical Chinese household, when you want to compliment your child or you're proud of your child, or you're telling someone about it, you often say he or she is disciplined. So if the child struggles in a subject or not very good at something, we automatically assume it's due to laziness.
Yep. Yes, we do.
So it's kind of like, you know, it's embedded in the language that we are just not accepting of you not being good at something as a born trait. And the belief is that if you try hard enough with careful, methodical approaches and practice relentlessly, you can be good at anything. So an example would be, this is really interesting, and a lot of people may not kind of know. If you go to China and then, you know, you want to compliment someone who's reached a certain level of success, let's say either in athletic achievements or in academic achievements, or even they built their own business or have their own art studio, what have you. Then you compliment them, and when you look at their work and you go, oh my God, you're so extremely talented, you would think this is an amazing compliment. But the traditional Chinese people typically would find them actually coming back being very defensive about it. And they would repeatedly tell you how hard they worked and how much they sacrificed to get to where they are, because to them, that is the true compliment.
This makes me think of two of my favorite bands. First one being BTS and the second one being Blackpink.
this is right along Ethan's taste in music, for those who don't know him.
Pink.
Who don't know him well, his favorite band growing up was Spice Girls. But anyway, for those
that who... That was supposed to be a secret.
I think most people know already by now. But for those of you, if you have lived under a rock for the past few years and you're not familiar with these bands, then please Google them. Blackpink is a girl band and BTS is a boy band. And they are the top earners of Korean pop music. So we call it K-pop these days, but they have gone global lately. And so there are these two groups of bands. And if you really hear them sing, and perform, you can see that they do it flawlessly in unison when it comes to dancing and singing. And the Blackpink's recent collaboration with Selena Gomez totally put them kind of on the global radar for everybody, not just in Asian countries.
Yeah, and I really like that video. Just so you know.
Of course you do.
But this just talks about some of the work that needed to be involved in order for these bands to come together. Did you want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, for sure. So we probably all, or at least know the show Making the Band. I think that was back in the aughts.
Right? Oh, yeah. That was like the 2000s, I think.
Right. In early aughts or even 90s, it goes back to how like these record labels recruit young children. And I think Disney does that really well, like Britney Spears and even Ryan Gosling, like some of the really famous actors and performers came from that kind of training. So they were part of the Minnie Mouse or Mickey Mouse Club or what have you. So they get recruited at a very early age, and then they train them to be this like pop star. So that that's in US and Canada, but in Korea and now today in China and Japan, they take it to a whole different level. So what they do is they don't actually just recruit the kids with talent and who come forward themselves, but they actually host these massive kind of auditioning process to all the children as young as 6 or 7 years old. So they pick out the ones they feel, and they pick a lot of them. It's not just like, okay, you have talent or you love music. That doesn't really matter on their books. So they pick them out. They can grow to be quite attractive. And then they have some kind of performance ability or what have you. And then they group these kids in this sort of camp style boarding school, and they actually train them relentlessly and to see who comes out on top in terms of their performance style, their popularity, and also very important aspect in this Asian way of manufacturing pop stars is the stamina and the persistence to be able to be the best dancer and the best singer of them all. So they go through this massive kind of filtering process until the ones that that make it to the top, and then they become these like crazy big pop stars, but they're still under tremendous control of these record labels, and they still train 8 to 10 hours a day. So to their way of approach to this is it's completely manufactured, and not only that, talent is practiced. Talent is not something that you came with.
How can this have any downside?
Of course there is like downside. So let's talk about the pros first, right? So everything I think has two sides of the story. I think it's really amazing in our Asian philosophy to instill this kind of work ethic in children. We don't leave it to children to say that you develop it on your own. We try to instill it in a very early stage. I think there are a lot of parents who are in the same boats, regardless of whether you're Asian background or not. I'm not very good a job at this, but the idea is you really give them this value when they're young. And this way of thinking is really great at producing uniform above average achievements in people. So it's kind of evident, I think a lot of Asian families expect their kids to have good jobs and to go to university and to have really above average academic achievements and in career as well. And you're also encouraging them to find a way to practice and constantly tweaking their methodology to be better at what they do. So eventually you put in enough effort, I think these kids are going to become good at some things. This is very famously quoted in Malcolm Gladwell's best-selling book, The Outlier. The threshold for practice is 10,000 hours. So if you can get yourself to focus and practice 10,000 hours, you can really become good at that. On the flip side, though, to some degree, I think it does ignore a person or individual's natural leanings. And it does make you much more likely to spend time making up your weaknesses rather than working to highlight your strengths. Because I think as human beings, we naturally want to make up something we're not good at. And with this philosophy, and you end up spending all your time practicing the things that you're not very good at so that you could be like everybody else, other than discovering what you truly are good at and actually highlighting those strengths. So as a result, I think it does fail to some level to recognize some of the true exceptionalities in people, the things that you're really good at and the things that you're really passionate about. As Ethan and I are kind of lucky because we have experienced both philosophies and systems, mm-hmm. and we're also exposed in an environment. There's a lot of diversity of parenting around us. So we can truly learn from everything and take the good and leave the bad and find that balance that not only tailors to us as parents, also tailors to what our children need.
Let's now talk about difference number three, parent-child relationship.
Yeah, that's, I think, a very big difference in Eastern and Western philosophy, and especially among the tiger parents. Although in recent years, we have to admit that there has been a much more Western influence in Asia. So this difference has been narrowed quite a bit. But the fundamentals remain somewhat, I think they're clear delineation in philosophy. So in Chinese philosophy, this is going back to thousands of years of Confucius days, of course, the parents are considered elders with experience, wisdom, and power. So they should be respected by their children at all times, and children are taught to follow rules set by their parents. So it's definitely not a democratic system in the household. The parents are more authoritarian, and it's expected that they set the authority of the family. And in Asian culture, we generally just do not regard our parents as our friends. In Western culture, I think there's much wider diversity on the dynamic of the parent-child relationship, as at least from what I've observed. And then also there has been a big shift and change of Western parenting philosophy in the 20th century or in the last 100 years. So how the parents viewed this relationship should be back in, say, early 1920s was very different from 1950s, the post-war era, and is very different from what it is today. However, I do observe in today, we're talking 2021 here, in Western society, that parents do feel they want to be their kids' friends much more, and they want to be liked by their children much more. So they have somewhat of a perceived friendship going with their kids, especially with older kids. And they still tend to be much more accepting in terms of the tone the kids talk back to them. And when the kids are breaking the rules or disobey the parents, the consequences are usually not as harsh and things are a little bit more accepted. But in Asia, I think the traditional value still persists in many areas of family life. An example would be if we walk around on the street in Canada, US, or in a Western society, and if we see a parent yelling at the kid, like berates the kids in public, I think people's reactions are very telling of the difference in beliefs. People here tend to be much more likely to judge the yelling parent and feel sympathetic to the child. But when the roles are reversed, when the child yells at the mom or dad or an elderly person in the family, we tend to think here, oh, the child is being a child, or, you know, he or she is emotional or just upset. While in Asia, like, or in China at least, it is usually the opposite. It is often perceived normal or necessary when a parent asserts power in public over a child. We think, oh, you know, mom and dad is doing what they need to do to keep the child in line. But if we witness a child yelling at mom and dad or grandparents or, you know, auntie and uncles, we tend to really judge. And the way we judge is that the kids are behaving this way because the parents are spoiling them and they don't have adequate discipline, and that could eventually potentially ruin the kids for life. So that's kind of what's going on in people's mind.
Now, that's just a really extreme example, but I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And plus, I find the difference between East and West has like totally blurred in recent years. And I think we kind of cross-adopt different philosophies from all over the world. It's not really a clear-cut line anymore. But there are also fewer tiger parents that are still very old-fashionedly authoritative. We tend to care about our kids' opinion much more. And how strict parents are really, I find, vary from family to family. I have encountered families who are, you know, Canadian, born or coming from Europe, and they're much more strict than Ethan and I. In our family, though, I think Ethan and I have a mixed approach as well. We put our foot down when it comes to this aspect, the respect aspect. So talking back and being rude is never tolerated in our household. So this is like my true Chinese upbringing coming out.
Oh, yeah.
So we try to maintain some level of hierarchy in the family because we, and, you know, and we're not, we're not necessarily right. It's just the way we've decided to parent. We don't personally believe parents should be on equal footing as children, not when they're young anyway. But we, what we do differently is, although it's not tolerated, their rudeness is not tolerated, but we do try to find out the reasons why they felt the need to be rude in the first place. So we want to understand and know how they feel, what emotions that they were experiencing to lead them to that point, and then try to solve the underlying issue than simply just putting a stop to it.
Speaking of parenting style, I'm going to put you on the spot right now. What do you think our parenting style is? Do we even have one?
That's a really good question. To be honest, we're often seen by our friends as when we're hanging out with our friends who typically don't have an East Asian Chinese background, we're seen to be a little bit on the strict side. So we're sometimes can be even perceived as harsh. And when we hang out with our Chinese or East Asian friends, we're seen as not strict enough, and we're too like relaxed when it comes to a lot of things like academic studies.
If I hear you right, then it seems like we kind of suck at both, huh?
It's so true. We do. So please, please don't learn from us. We're just talking to you about the different styles for fun. This is definitely not something you should take tips from our parenting. And by the way, we parent according to what we think our children need. There's nothing to say we do it right. And, you know, our children are very different from your children as well. So for academics, truth to be told, that we're very relaxed because I feel like the world is changing. Although my childhood of a typical Chinese academic training benefited me in many aspects of my life, I also often felt short in my ability to solve life's simple problems when I was a young adult. And then also I lacked emotional intelligence, which is something I had to work really hard to make up for in my later adult life. And then there was also a bit of lack of understanding or just completely being ignored when I was a child of what I was truly good at and what I truly loved. The fact that I received almost no like training in art and design or even communications, like the things I kind of just really naturally thrived at, I didn't really get a chance to practice in those. So because of those reasons, we tend to let our kids handle their own or navigate their own academic studies to a certain degree and encourage them to be okay at failing at something, as long as you learn from it and make a comeback.
But our kids still need to get good grades, right? I mean, we still have some Asian expectations, so they can't come back with a C. Is that acceptable?
I think you're right. You're right. I think we do have, we give our kids full support and we do expect them or demand them for them to try hard and do well in school. I think I'm okay with C's, honestly, as long as it's temporary. But just don't tell our kids that I actually said that.
But for other things, we don't really quite demand them to practice too much either, like things such as piano or sports.
I think that's another reason entirely. To be honest, it's also very tiring to be a tiger mom. It requires like a tremendous amount of work and devotion. And Ethan and I are managing our careers on top of that, we're trying to be good parents, and it's just a lot. So we're too tired to be on them all the time. We give them the opportunities, but I don't want to be constantly monitoring them and spending hours a day just to make sure they do their work. Truth be told, we want to have a little life for ourselves as well.
Oh yeah, some parenting fun, right? Now, you mentioned respect a little bit earlier on that piece of respect. So we quite have Asian ways for that respect piece.
I would say so. I would say that's where you and I kind of adopt the tiger parenting a little bit. And, you know, there's nothing to say it's the right way. But the reason why we do it is not just because we were raised this way. We truly believe that the language, the words they use, the small attitude day in and day out will be a self-fulfilling act in life or self-fulfilling prophecy over time. And I'll tell you why I think this way. That comes from the philosophy number two, that I mentioned earlier, the talent or versus practice. I do believe respect and appreciation for other people is actually practiced over time to be instilled and for the children to truly believe in it. It's not something that I think it is. In some instances, they intrinsically grow that desire and understand life in such a way they choose to be appreciative and considerate to other people. But in my mind, I think the daily practice of it also makes them believe that is the way it's supposed to be. And I believe it's a good value to instill in them. So because of that, we try to encourage them to act in the way, talk in the way over time that is considerate and appreciative to other people. And I think that would have a big impact on how they see the people around them who are supporting them, and then how they see the rest of the family members when they grow up. So being respectful in our household, it's not a choice. We really put our foot down on this. And I can let you know, honestly, it has not been easy, because our son actually has more of an impulsive nature, and he has some challenges with his verbal impulsiveness, and he's really working hard on it, and he's made tremendous progress. But growing up, you know, through toddlerhood, you know, the early years, and now before he turns to a teenager, it has not been the easiest journey. But we just couldn't and we won't let go of rudeness and bad attitude in our household. And that is the boundary we set, and the area Ethan and I are willing to put in the work that's required.
With this concludes our episode on tiger parenting. Thank you for letting us become part of your life today. If you like what you heard, please forward it to friends, family, whoever, and just make and subscribe to our channel. We wish you progress and prosperity in the year of the ox, and look forward to having you join us for our next episode. Thank you.